Market moving insight and analysis. Join Jim Cramer, David Faber, and me, Carl Quintanilla, on the opening bell hour of CNBC Squawk on the Street. Good Tuesday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Mike Santoli here at Post 9 of the New York Stock Exchange. David Faber's at HQ. Kramer has the morning off. Futures holding on to some gains here, even though monthly core CPI does come in about a tenth hot, more than half driven by shelter and gas. Yields bounce, settling a little bit. June rate cut odds largely stable here. Our roadmap begins with the macro picture. Futures swing as inflation does tick higher. And Jamie Dimon says the economy is booming, but that a recession may still be on the table.
Plus, quote, enormous amounts of demand, Oracle's cloud revenue surging, fueled by growing AI needs. And the Boeing challenge, citing delayed aircraft deliveries, Southwest cuts capacity and therefore rethinks its 2024 financial forecast.
Let's begin with this market reaction to CPI. We mentioned a tenth hot at four tenths. Shelter and gas, about 60% of that. Some surprises in here, Mike. Apparel up six tenths is a topic of discussion.
Yes. I think what the market did, and there was a real quick reflex where it said, okay, this is a hotter than expected. You have to run more of the bearish playbook. Bonds sold off, yields higher, stocks backed off. Then the rethink was, well, the things that matter and that will translate into what the PCE inflation number is going to say, combined with how high a threshold was set by Powell last week for changing their premise that they are preparing for likely rate cuts in the summer. So I think all that fit together, the core services stubbornly, you know, firm inflation readings there do not necessarily translate into the PCI is going to go the same direction. So that's part of the mix. We are also kind of geared for shelter being stubborn. And I do think even, you didn't see that uptick like we saw in January. So all that mixed together, combined with, I think, the equity market saying, the AI trade's back on for all these different reasons. NVIDIA's going to bounce today. It was a whole day and a half of weakness. You got the Oracle numbers. You have AMD saying happy things. You have B of A raising its overall S&P earnings forecast because of AI. So, in other words, we got CPI out of the way. We'll see if we can make something of it beyond that.
Yeah, we're going to get to the B of A, going to 250. Yep. That's a street high on the top down. David, as for more CPI, I guess people will look to some relief in food where we got a couple of goose eggs.
Yeah, there. You know, again, I sort of leave it to you guys and a lot of our other experts to go through the numbers themselves in terms of why transportation services was up 9.9. Shelter, obviously, we also keep an eye on up 5.7 as you take a look at futures. Mike, I got to come back to you, though. So it was a day and a half. It was, what, 36 hours of concern about the AI trade, and now we're back? I heard you say that. I want a little more.
I think I don't even know if it was concern about the big picture trade. It was concern that the leading stocks in that area had become too overheated, overowned, crowded, vulnerable. Now, I'm not saying it's over, but you had 2 days of almost, you know, pitch-perfect rotation out of the big leaders, and there was a benefit on some of the recent weak stocks like Alphabet and Apple. People have talked about this. My favorite poster child for all this effect in general, not so much AI, but the momentum effect, has been Costco, which was down 10% off of its Friday morning high because it's in the NASDAQ 100. I mean, that's kind of the silliness. And it was also at a record high valuation going into its own earnings. So no real change of the underlying story, either with AI or Costco. But you did have this mechanical effect, or at least a repositioning effect that maybe has, I'm not saying run its course, but it's definitely giving way to the old playbook of by the leaders today, at least in the pre-market action.
We mentioned Jamie Dimon's comments. Covered a lot of ground in this digital meeting, talking about the broad economy, saying that the U.S. is in kind of a boom. Covered the possibility of recession. Covered the fact that he will never buy Bitcoin himself. Take a listen.
If you look at the the world economy, take the United States, for example, it's kind of doing fine. I mean, you could almost say it's kind of a boomer right now. The world is pricing in, I'm talking about the United States mostly here, but it's a little bit around the world, a soft landing. And they kind of price it in at 70 or 80%. You see the stock prices, which are not bubble yet, but they're high. You see in credit spreads. I think the chance of that soft landing over the next year or two is half that, which means I think the chance of a mild recession or hard recession, like 65%. And the worst case of a recession would be stagflation. So that's almost off the table if you look at people's projections. I wouldn't take it off the table yet.
Goes on to say, David, that AI is pretty much central to every conversation right now. I think he called the innovation that's taking place unbelievable, and then had some comments on the election. You got two men, they're on the older side, neither can get sick. It's nerve-wracking. It's going to be a circus.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's always we use Jamie in part because he doesn't hold back and he sort of says what's on his mind. I always talk about he, even though he is not a founder, he talks like one in some ways because he doesn't have a corporate counsel in his head saying don't say that, or his corporate communications head saying don't say that. So you do get unvarnished views from him. I mean, Mike, he's been much more negative just for as long as I can remember in terms of the course of the economy than any number of his other peers, perhaps, who run banks and or sort of the broader prognosticators out there. And he continues to be, as you just heard, saying, you know, he kind of cuts it in half, the chance for a soft landing versus what seems to be the consensus.
Yeah, and he says over the next year or two. So once you stretch it out to 2 years, I think everybody's macro forecasts start to lose some conviction. But no, you're absolutely right. He just by temperament and orientation and maybe professional necessity or preference, he decides to focus on the potential risks. Because if the economy's fine, J.P. Morgan's going to thrive. If there's no rate shock, they can handle whatever's coming at it. And in fact, if things get a little bit worse, they're likely better positioned to weather it. And so I do think that that all is an outgrowth of that general perspective that he has. He has long thought, when rates were much lower, that it was ridiculous and they should be much higher. And he seems to be anchored on, you know, an 80s, 90s norm for exactly where rates should be. So the idea that maybe the Fed shouldn't rush to cut in June is fine. But when you're within the Fed and you have your models and you have your framework and you say rates are above 5%, and even if inflation is sticky here, it's 3-ish percent, that tells them that there's room to normalize. So I don't think that there's a big kind of nasty argument going on between, you know, Jamie Dimon and what the Fed's going to do. But maybe it's a matter of, of exactly pacing and priorities in terms of what they're trying to accomplish.
Carl?
Yeah. Is the discussion right now, Mike, about they're going in June for sure? I mean, odds would tell you that. Yeah. And it's more about the total number of cuts for the year.
At this point, yes. Something would have to probably come along to disturb that. Look, they can. You know, we're going to get the summary of economic projections next week after the Fed meeting, and that will, you know, bring it up to date in terms of what they're thinking they're going to do. I do think that's now the default assumption is June looks pretty likely. After that, whether they follow it in July and they want to get one in more in September, three seems like where things are coalescing. I do think it's important to remember. I mean, it wasn't long ago. What was it? You know, several weeks ago that Powell took March off the table. So March has been off the table for that long.
It's still 16% May.
Well, yeah, exactly. So there's always a something might
yes.
break
yes.
kind of an insurance policy in there. And markets have been fine. You know what I mean? So there was a time when we thought, it's March, make or break for the markets. And that clearly wasn't the case.
Right. Let's move on to Oracle this morning. Surging in the pre-market, double digits, on track to open at a fresh record. Earnings beat. Revenue does get a lift on some strong demand for the cloud, driven by AI. David, they throw a couple mentions of NVIDIA in there last night. Jefferies goes to 150. Barclays 147. Got an upgrade over I can't see which one that is, but there's at least one upgrade today. Pretty good response.
William Blair.
Was it Blair?
Yeah.
Yeah. There are a number of very positive pieces out, as you might imagine. It seems to be not just, listen, the numbers themselves in terms of where they, I guess they met much of the consensus, but the guidance seems to certainly be hardening the position of those who believe that they are in the midst of I guess back to Jamie Dimon, sort of an AI renaissance here, which we talk about every day, as we should. And they are the beneficiaries of it in terms of, I guess, reiterating what their fiscal 2026 guidance for as much as $65 billion in revenue and 45 plus non-GAAP operating margins, indicating potential for upside to these targets. And obviously talking there about the cloud offerings in particular that, Mike, are the great beneficiary of, again, this trend we talk about it in its earliest days, generative AI, the demands it puts on data centers, on obviously the chips that will run it, namely NVIDIA, and everything that goes along with it that can be offered to a certain extent by Oracle and its cloud offerings as they sort of move into this this new world as well.
Exactly. So, yeah, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure is where it's, the beneficiaries of the business lie. And it is very interesting when you have these companies that, you know, for years were just cash cows. It's slow and steady. It's just free cash flow and buybacks and financial engineering. And now they are plays and they're capturing a huge part of this business and well-positioned in it. Yes, it's going to take a lot of investment. So free cash flow is coming down a little bit in the near term for Oracle relative to earnings just because of the investment. But the market seems okay with it. And because it has this legacy tech kind of overlay, it's 20 times earnings and not 40 or 50. And so if you start to get aggressive in valuing the parts of this business that are really seeing tremendous demand that they can't meet, and those revenue estimates start going up, then it just gets revalued in a hurry. And it seems to be what's going on. Now, 1 quarter ago, there was a big disappointment. A lot of that was sort of CapEx plans, and the street was not really prepared. Only half of all sell-side analysts have a buy on Oracle.
Yeah.
So there is sort of room for people to be persuaded, David, that maybe the story is real and durable.
To that point, I mean, I'm looking at a Citi note this morning saying the cloud revenue remains sluggish. Strong bookings offer optimism for recovery. And they, you know, they, again, are neutral to your point, Mike, as are a number of firms on the stock, seeing long-term targets as, quote, rather aggressive and would like to see further traction on improving cloud gross margins and the autonomous database modernization. So there are still some who are less than positive, perhaps, that that should be seen as a positive as well, I guess, because their opinions can get turned.
And there's always that little bit of an impediment of, sure, I want to own Oracle because they're going to be a big player in this new world. When you buy Oracle, you also buy a lot of HR software, and it's been a roll-up, and there's, you know, some integration issues with recent acquisitions or whatever it might be. So in other words, it's not a clean, pure leverage play on just AI, and some people, you know, would prefer to get those. So that's where the valuation difference is going to come in, Carl.
You mentioned the B of A note from Savita Subramanian today. They do take their S&P earnings to 250 this year. They were at 235. That's 12% year-on-year growth. They talk about what she calls a virtuous cycle beginning. It starts with AI investments. It moves to the semis. It moves to networking. But then she goes on, David, to talk about the things you've been interested in lately: electrification, utilities, commodities. And then she ends up with 25 EPS at 275. That's going to be up 10% on that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, perhaps we haven't talked about it. Mike may have been focused on it at other reports during the course of the day. But the move in some of the utilities has been somewhat interesting to watch, with this idea that we're going to need more power. But of course, that doesn't happen overnight. You've got to actually build it, and that is a long time to come. But to your point, Carl, or at least some of the references she's making in this note, you know, the data centers that are going to be built already have access to power. That's the first thing you actually lock in prior to even putting a shovel in the ground, to a certain extent. But you are going to have it as a gating issue, potentially, in terms of building more of these to fuel the future of AI. And we're going to need a lot more power. But whether, Mike, that move in the utilities and or those that provide power in this country is justified based on that, because you can only get so much capacity out of what they've got. Yeah. And then a lot of it is years and years away. And obviously, it's a highly regulated business as well.
I think in the very near term, the utilities trade was, this area is washed out relative to the index. There's been massive outflows from utility funds. And it just seemed like for a trade, when we were selling the winners and buying the losers, it worked. Yeah, in terms of the long term, whether, you know, utilities can actually provide the supply of power and price it right. Yeah, much bigger question. That's to me not what the past couple of days have been trading on.
When we come back this morning, a tough morning for Southwest and where Boeing fits into the picture. A lot of airline news, including some comments from Delta this morning and Alaska Air. We'll get to some retail, Kohl's earnings, couple calls on DKS and Dollar Tree as futures hang in there in a moment.
Shares of Southwest are down sharply in the pre-market. You can see that. The airline says it's reevaluating its full-year guidance and cutting its Boeing jet deliveries forecast. It all starts with Boeing. Let's get over to Phil LeBeau, who can explain what's going on here. Phil.
David, you have an all-Boeing fleet. You're going to pay the price when Boeing is going through what it's going through right now. As you mentioned, Southwest, as you take a look at shares, down as much as 8% pre-market. pulling its full year guidance, basically not, maybe not pulling, but saying we're reevaluating it. We will give you new guidance, our latest guidance, when it reports Q1 results, which we expect at the end of April. And it's also cutting its max delivery plans, now expecting 46 deliveries this year. Originally, they thought they were going to get 79 this year. Clearly, that is not going to happen, and they will not be getting any MAX 7 deliveries this year. They are not expecting it. The plane hasn't even been certified yet, so highly unlikely we're going to see the MAX 7 deliveries. We may not even see MAX 7 deliveries in 25. It depends on whether or not it gets through the certification process. Meanwhile, Delta giving different guidance, and we heard from them earlier this morning on Squawk Box, the company expecting its Q1 earnings near the top of its guidance. So there's no change in the guidance, but they are expecting it to come in near the top end of between 25 cents and 50 cents a share. The street, by the way, was at 36 cents a share for the first quarter heading into today. Here's Ed Bastian, CEO of Delta, talking this morning on Squawk Box about the strength of demand right now.
Continues to accelerate, and it's our highest margin product. We continue to put more of it out into the marketplace. International is also something that's at its highest level. Last year, our highest performing routes in our system were international, particularly transatlantic, and that was a change from where we were pre-COVID.
Ed Bastian talking about the strength of international demand. Transatlantic was huge last year. It'll be huge this summer as well. And they're noticing strong booking trends right now. As you take a look at American, JetBlue, and United, we should also point out that American's Q1 loss, they expect that to be near the low end of the guidance that they have previously given. So not a change there, but clearly they're seeing some pressure on the cost side, especially when you're looking at jet fuel. Carl, I'll send it back to you.
Phil, really quick on the Southwest and the Alaska impact, not just from the capacity that they're not going to get as expected, but also the impact of, in the case of Alaska, of that what that one flight did to demand.
Huge. I mean, you cannot overstate how much importance the industry has when it comes to deliveries of new 737 MAXes. This was the year when so many airlines, whether it's Alaska, Southwest, look at Ryanair. It's got to bring down its expectations in terms of 2024 because it's not going to take delivery of as many MAXes. So the implications here for the entire industry are enormous. The MAX is the bread and butter for Boeing, just as the A320 and A321 are the bread and butter for Airbus. Those are the main planes that fly people around the world, those narrow-body workhorse planes. And the MAX right now, the production is just not there.
Then there's the audit. I know you brought it up with Bastian, but the number of instances in which there was alleged non-compliance, it's pretty startling count in the Times today.
Yeah, what was it, 33 out of how many? Out of 89 production checks that the FAA auditors were looking at. This is according to the New York Times. By the way, we just heard from the FAA. We asked them if they could confirm those details that are in the New York Times article. They have declined to confirm the details, simply saying that the audit was finished, but they will continue to be aggressive in terms of checking on the safety and quality at Boeing and limiting production capacity. Remember, it's limited to 38 a month for this year, for the foreseeable future, until the FAA says, you know what, we're comfortable that you are doing what you're supposed to be doing. And one other note, guys, the audit about the Spirit is just as damaging in this report in the New York Times. Half of the production checks that were checked, more than half of the production checks that were audited, they failed. So this is a damaging report, both for Spirit as well as for Boeing.
Phil, appreciate that. A good roundup of all the aviation news today. There is a ton of it. That's our Phil LeBeau. Still to come this morning, shares of On taking a hit, down double digits as the company posts some quarterly results and guidance, a double miss in the guide below. The co-CEOs of the athletic footwear and apparel maker will join us at Post 9 later on this morning. Meanwhile, take a look at the pre-market. Trying to hold some gains here as the yields do remain elevated, 10-year just north of 414. Don't go anywhere. We've been talking about some of the jostling going on in the bond market post-CPI as the 10-year gets back to 414 or so. Fitch is out just now, Mike, and says that the data is a sober reminder of the tendency of inflation to perpetuate itself. They do look specifically at three-month annualized core, which was 3 in October and has gone to 3.8.
and the so-called super core, you know, if you want to really narrow it down as something that's maybe indicative of a longer-term trend, it has turned higher, you know, in the last couple of months. So it goes along the same lines. It really comes down to the market's tolerance and the Fed's tolerance for us being, you know, one percentage point shy of target. And by the way, on PCE, we're closer to the 2% target. And it does seem right now, it seems like the suspense is still there in terms of what PPI is going to have on Thursday and how that feeds in going into the Fed meeting. So, yeah, you had an immediate response in the bond market. Two-year note yield plunged as if we're going to look through the hot core, and then it elevated from there. So we'll see how the stock market handles it. All yields are still, though, within this 3 or 4 month range.
Let's get the opening bell here in the CNBC real-time exchange. With the big board, it is Gates Industrial, manufacturer of power transmission belts, celebrating its Capital Markets Day. At the NASDAQ, it's Rocked, an e-commerce technology company, and Red Bull Racing, celebrating its partnership and commitment to diversity in Formula One. As we try to hang on to the mid-5100s here, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're, you know, 1.3% off the all-time high, something like that. There has not really been a proper pullback in the broad indexes. We talk about the rotation. It seems like we got a couple of days of that. And today, it seems like the story is going to be Oracle. We talked about that. It's a leader in the S&P 500, up almost 10% in the early going. And then NVIDIA does seem like the, you know, we're bouncing almost 3%. So you had about an approximate 10% correction off the intraday high on Friday. That seems to be the storyline, is exactly whether that refreshed the leadership or something else has been going on. You know, even with, let's say, Bank of America's new $250 S&P 500 2024 target, you're at 20 times that. Right? You're more than 20 times that. So you still have this, I think, psychological high hurdle for exactly how good things have to be to get you to buy the overall market and say that we have a lot of upside here after an 8% run going into March, which is what we've had in the S&P 500. So to me, that's not going to go away, this idea that the market doesn't owe us very much. But within it, you've seen this real willingness of investors to allow equity exposures to stay high.
Yeah.
And, you know, credit markets are strong and yields are well-behaved so far.
Although Savita would come back and say equity allocations are basically where they were in 95.
Yes.
Margin financing, margin debt, nowhere near approaching the highs of 21. Every target increase is accompanied by these reassurances that valuation's not crazy.
Well, and of course, you can hive off the most expensive, higher growth parts of the S&P and say the rest of the market looks cheaper. You know, to say that things like equity positioning looks like mid-90s, not late 90s, that still leaves the question of, are we ever getting back to late 90s? So I agree that it's not as if retail is over-leveraged long stocks. But more tactical positioning looks aggressive. That's the way I would square that a little bit here. So not to say we got to go down a lot, but the market has done people's reallocation into equities for them to a large degree. I know even B of A's private client, they're up to 62% equity. Okay, they were at 65% a couple years ago. So there's upside to that. The Mag 7 is not as expensive on earnings as it was in late 2021. So you can maybe lean on that as well. So the macro stuff, you can sort of come at it from either direction and make a case that, you know, there's theoretical upside. We can get a little more fully positioned than we are right now.
It's interesting. You mentioned NVIDIA. I remember people saying in February, two big catalysts of the month, Fed meeting and NVIDIA earnings. This month, it's Fed meeting and GTC, NVIDIA's conference.
Right. Yeah, it's hilarious. And, you know, it's definitely taken over the, you know, the sort of hearts and minds trade in terms of people who look for open-ended growth. A lot of back and forth as to whether the conference next week would be just an obvious sell the news event or whether it would be something that would really recharge the story and sort of push it out multiple years. I don't know how to handicap that, but that's absolutely true. I mean, it's as much as I'd like to say, listen, this should be about broader earnings growth and where we are in the cycle and whether the Fed's going to stick the landing. It is really about, can we get incrementally more excited about the long-term, you know, AI trends? And even the, you know, Savita at B of A talking about AI capital investment virtuous cycle. are there any net losers from that? Like, where's the money coming from, right? Is it just not as much in the way of buybacks?
Well, one theory would be that buybacks suffer and CapEx benefits.
That's
right,
fine.
Right.
Yeah, which works in the short term,
Yeah, definitely. NVIDIA had a chance to say something at the Morgan Stanley TMT conference. They chose to basically reiterate the earnings call, but we'll see what we get next week, and I know Kramer's going to be all over that event in San Jose. NVIDIA is the market leader. I'm sorry, Oracle's the market leader at the moment, followed by 3M, which does have a big management shuffle after a tough six-year run for Mike Roman.
Yeah, so a new newly appointed CEO, he had come out of Harris, so kind of the defense contractor industry, very much a win in investors' minds in terms of how that company was managed. I think there's also a general sense out there that this is a company that, you know, the conglomerate structure worked for a really long time to kind of have this nice, smooth earnings growth, and it hasn't worked for years, at least in a seamless way. So reshuffling the portfolio, people probably have in mind what Culp's been able to do over at GE in terms of deciding what are we good at, what are we not. And so it seems like an extra reason to think that 3M might be able to, you know, get some of the glory of the broader industrial sector, which has been incredibly strong, but very much in these specific areas where, you know, these earnings growth machines like Eaton Corp and Textron and those.
Right. David, if Jim were here, I'm sure, no doubt he would comment on the way in which Roman sort of tried to manage some of those legacy costs.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked so often, of course, about the enormous cost of litigation, whether it be PFAS and the various settlements or the military issues in terms of the hearing, the things you put in your ear to stop the loud noises. I forget the technical term for it, guys. Interesting to note here. I mean, yes, Roman has been in the job for a long, for some time. As you point out, Carl, he has faced any number of challenges given the litigation that we mentioned. And you can take a look at what the stock price has done during that period. But it's not like they're turning to a younger member here of previous of management. Brown is 61 years old. I got to check Mike Roman's age. I haven't had a chance. Maybe you guys can, but I think he may even be younger. So, you know, this is an interesting change. Roman will continue as exec chair, as I think we've already pointed out. So there is that. But all right, Roman is a little bit older, I'm told. But, you know, you're not, it's not as though you're bringing in a youngster. It's always nice, actually, guys, when the CEOs are still older than I am. So applause
like,
to both
like the pilots and the dentists.
Yes, applause to that from my side here. But I did want to note that. I think he's a well-regarded executive, as Brown. You can see the reaction, and the stock price is quite positive. And to Mike's point, you know, we'll see in terms of portfolio realignment in some way. But really, the big issue that's been dogging this company for quite some time has been the cost of litigation related to groundwater and the hearing mitigation.
As for media, David, we did get some decent Oscar ratings, four-year high, almost 20 million. Good news for Disney. We had that video going after Peltz yesterday, and then we got a little Paramount news today. What do you think?
I don't know. You're referring, I guess, to this Axios report about Apollo. You know, Paramount is so little. I mean, we talk about it. Obviously, people care about it, but Apple spends in one day the market cap of this company. I mean, it just the competition, when you look at the broader picture in terms of the big tech companies, whether it be Apple or Amazon or even Netflix, obviously, which is far smaller, but sort of lumped in there, not to mention the Metas of the world. It just there's no real comparison. That said, the efforts continue, Carl, to some extent, to try to see if there's a way to have a change in control here. I've talked often about the Sherry Red, the Redbird / David Ellison partnership, which would involve buying National Amusements, paying Sherry Redstone a premium there, and then taking control that way of Paramount, merging in Skydance, the studio that Ellison has, with Paramount Studio. That would be a process that would require a special committee vote, but it would be two-step. You wouldn't do one if you couldn't do the other. So you need to know in advance you're going to get that special committee vote in favor of being able to merge the studio before you agree to pay the premium for Sherry Redstone. So what do you offer in terms of public shareholders, not to mention they're going to need to raise a lot of money in terms of just putting the capital structure in a better place, as much as $3 billion is what I've been hearing. So there are no shortage of challenges to a potential deal here. Apollo's been hanging around. They like some of those local stations, for example, or you know, CBS-related things. We'll see what happens. I'm not hearing, though, what would be the big thing, which is just a major company stepping up and buying the entire thing.
Yeah, I mean, David, it already kind of has an LBO capital structure, right?
Yes.
So it's not as if, you know, you have that juice you could do if you're a new buyer to lever it up.
No, you can't add, exactly, Mike, you can't really add a lot of debt. And in fact, my point is that you'd need to sort of sell $3 billion worth of equity.
Yeah.
For Paramount itself. That's the sort of the plan. So you take control, then you raise more money via additional equity, which obviously is dilutive. So, you know, we'll follow it. We'll update people as we see fit, but, you know, certainly responding to any number of these stories that are out there, I guess we got to do that sometimes. And, you know, we'll see if Apollo really gets anywhere.
Speaking of selling equity, Arm Holdings, a big lockup expiration, I believe today, as stocks almost a double since the September new issue. But there's been a lot of discussion, David, about what a big test the stock faces this week.
Yeah, I mean, we've remarked so often, of course, about after earnings, that incredible move, and pointed out many times, of course, the float is very small, hence you would have those kinds of potential moves that did not seem reflective, really, Mike, of the overall fundamentals. Not that they aren't strong, but were they really that strong? I mean, we were talking, you can see what the six-month chart looks like, and that move of late, really all much of that percentage move took place just in a few days after earnings. More shares out, Mike, typically does mean oftentimes, it doesn't always happen, but many people do shorten it, at least when they think the lockup's coming, or at least when there's more shares to actually be able to do that with and to borrow.
For sure. And the high on that chart is around 150. So it is, you know, $25 off of that. It was very kind of squeezy on the way up, right, in the reaction to earnings. But, yeah, I don't know that it would be a game changer just to have more wider float on this stock at some point, gets put into the indexes, and that gets sort of, you know, soaked up to some degree. So I don't know that it would necessarily be the thing that would hang over the stock for very long, unless, of course, you have, you know, your big anchor investor that wants out.
Yeah, which they have indicated they don't. Obviously,
yeah, exactly.
It's a great win for SoftBank. Certainly, given where the thing went public and the gain that they have right now, I think their frustration to a certain extent is that their own stock price doesn't really reflect the underlying value as much as they might like at SoftBank, given that enormous move in value that they have seen with their really, I mean, 80-something%, 90% control of the economics there, Mike. But
yeah,
we'll see over time whether they do choose to sell any of it, at least to sort of realize some of those profits.
Tesla, weakness continues. It's taken out its lows for the year to date. Once again, getting into the 173 range. Going to take you back to levels last seen in May of 23. A few things going on. Musk is expected to visit the Berlin Gigafactory, possibly tomorrow, where that arson attack took place. Morgan Stanley's Adam Jonas talking about how the correlation between the share price and Bitcoin has really broken ever since the notably lower delivery forecast came about. And then Deutsche Bank yesterday saying they expect deliveries to miss this year by a pretty wide margin, even as they're trying to catch up to this slowing demand with price cuts.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, even Jonas, what does he attribute in terms of the stock price value that's attributable to the auto company?
It's like
75
a fifth.
Bucks.
Yeah,
so, you know, but that has been the main weight here, this idea that you can't just count on, you know, ever increasing market share for EVs and Tesla holding its share of those. In terms of the linkage to Bitcoin, I mean, that really broke down last summer, I'm going to say, in a decisive way. And that's because NVIDIA has taken over. So, you know, if we can look at NVIDIA versus Bitcoin versus Tesla, and really those things trade is in exactly that similar way of the types of people who want to, you know, put a lot of money in an aggressive way behind the big picture world-changing technology, however you define that. Of course, NVIDIA, You got charismatic founder. You have kind of a cult forming around his vision, similar to the kinds of energy that was driving Tesla for all those years. So you see, it's not that dissimilar on a one-year or year-to-date basis in terms of NVIDIA and Bitcoin.
Then you got this Washington Post story, David, where they say the former President Trump asked Musk last summer whether he'd be interested in buying Truth Social, according to two people with knowledge of that conversation. Didn't go very far.
You know, I guess it's not a bad time to refer people to DWAC, which is, of course, Digital World Acquisition Corp. That is the SPAC that is going to very soon de-SPAC with the acquisition that is planned of Trump Media, which includes Truth Social. And, you know, I know people may have a hard time sort of working through the numbers in terms of how many shares are going to be outstanding. I had it in front of me not that long ago. I apologize because I didn't know it was going to come up right now. But there's going to be a lot of shares out there. This thing is at $38.93. I mean, Trump alone, I believe, is going to have access to as many, I think it's just as many as 100 million shares. I want to do a little more work, guys. But the point is, even though he's locked up for 6 months, and I don't know how to view this story from the Washington Post, but he's going to, you know, conceivably at some point have access to an enormous amount of potential money if the stock stays where it is at 39. So, I mean, the vote scheduled, I think it was for March 22nd, guys, and this thing will close soon after. So I'll take a closer look. We may have more on it in the days ahead, but it's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. Definitely. Meantime, Dow's gone red here, about 30 points. We'll watch bonds as well. Talked about the 10-year reapproaching the 4 in the teens. But the big news after CPI will be the 10-year note auction today at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to keep a very close eye on that. We're back in a moment. Welcome back. On Holding, known for its athletic footwear and apparel, reporting a revenue miss in Q4. Shares are down this morning, better than 17%. Joining us here at Post 9 in a first on CNBC interview, Mark Moore, On Holding's co-CEO, and Martin Hoffman, co-CEO and CFO. Gents, it's nice to have you in the building. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Mark, is it about 4X? Is it broader than that? What's going on here in this first half?
Hey, I think we're not commenting on what's going on in the stock market. What we're doing is we're very much focused around executing on our mission, which is going to be being the most premium global sportswear brand. We're very happy with where consumer demand is. We're growing in running. We're growing apparel. We're growing on retail. And so I think everything that we're doing is according to the strategy, and it's according to what we communicated. So very happy with where we stand as a company.
You can't look past what's happening with currencies, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Swiss franc just gained value against every other currency. But for us, it's about how many shoes do we sell to the fans. So that's how we measure success. And so we need to take this out. And as Mark just said there, we had a super successful year, 55% more volume that we sold in 2023. Very strong holiday season. We are a premium brand. We sell full price, high margin. We increased our profitability. And now we expect 30% growth in this year. And so that's above our expectation to double our business in the next 3 years. That's what we communicated. So we're very positive.
I guess, Mark, given that you're growing so fast and obviously therefore taking a lot of market share, can you get a read on underlying consumer demand or behavior at this point, let's say this year relative to a year ago?
Yeah, I think we understand it relatively well. We have very good sellout data from our accounts. We understand how consumers convert. And so consumer demand is there. I think our big opportunity is to increase brand awareness. We're still a relatively small brand compared to some of the bigger players. And so we have ample opportunity in the US, but also in Asia Pacific to increase brand awareness. This is where we will invest in. More people should get to know On. And then we have enough point of sales with some of our wholesale partners, but also with our D2C engine to convert that increased brand awareness.
You mentioned margins, and gross margins did improve, right? Is it 60 plus at this point?
Yeah, so it's 59.6 for last year. Our goal this year is to clearly be at that 60% mark. So again, it's a testament to the premium position that we have. It's a super strong margin. And now we have a lot of leverage in our SG&A to really improve profitability, economies of scale, retail will be growing, the channels will change, more D2C. So this will drive our EBITDA, which is at least 16% to 16.5% goal.
We did see here, we got a US CPI number this morning where apparel was up 0.6 month on month. some are arguing we're sort of wringing as much goods deflation as we can out of the goods market. Are you seeing cost pressures sort of reaccelerate or be stubbornly high?
No, at the moment, I think we're in a good position. So we still have pricing power, and we can use this if we need to. But we are still growing, and we still have economies of scale also on the factory side. The supply chain, luckily, is in a very good position at the moment. So no congestions. We only have a very low share of air freight that we need. So that helps us to really now focus on executing the business towards the customer.
You mentioned a couple of times you're a premium brand. You want to kind of stay that way, I assume, with a link toward more performance. Does that limit things in the long term? I mean, in other words, not so much about fashion or casual, but it has to be, you know, someone who's somewhat either serious or very aware of the branding?
No, we don't think it's limiting at all, right? So I think in the end, we're bringing a premium product. We're bringing a performance product. And we're bringing product that becomes more and more sustainable to the market. And we can do that in more and more categories. So we spoke about growing apparel. We see demand for apparel way above our forecast, which is very, very positive. And Martin and I are showcasing some of the pieces that we'll launch pretty soon too. And then we can, besides growing and running, you know, we can enter new categories like training. And we will, for the first time, launch a tennis collection around Roland Garros and the French Open. And so I think there's a lot of categories that we can still tap into and where we can continue to grow as a premium sportswear brand.
Speaking of that, I mean, it's getting a lot warmer here on the East Coast this week. Summer season will be here. People will start running outdoors. We'll have the Olympics in July and August. Is seasonality more pronounced for you than your peers, would you say?
We're a global brand, so things are setting each other off. And we are also basically catering to consumer that is running, but is also doing other kinds of sports.
Right.
So it's not a strong impact. But you mentioned the Olympics, so of course that's our big focus. So it's a big brand moment for us. Paris is very close to our home. So we have our On Athletics club team ready to compete. Our tennis player, Iga Swiatek, Ben Shelton, ready to compete. And we have a big store already in Paris. We expect to open a second one on Champs-Élysées. So really being on the top street in Paris, present. So very excited about it.
Oh, that's good. Well, I'll be there. So maybe
I
you guys
not,
can.
We'll meet you there.
Yeah,
I guess.
We'll catch up in Paris.
Okay. We'll do a store interview then.
In August. Mark, Martin, thanks, guys, for coming in. It's good to
so
see you.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
Mike, thanks for joining us this hour. Still a lot more to come as the Dow tries to hold on to some gains once again. Don't go away. You've been listening to The Opening Bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
All opinions expressed by the Squawk on the Street participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information Squawk on the Street participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Squawk on the Street disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Squawk on the Street disclaimer.